unleash the hazard.
Welcome to InstaDeath Survivor Support Group, a podcast all about game books and the readers and writers who adore them. Today's guest is a legend of game books. He's authored or co-authored many of the classics, and he's responsible for entire new subgenres of interactive fiction. During his career spanning almost 40 years, he's written standout entries in several classic series, including Fighting Fantasy, Falcon, Way of the Tiger, and Fabled Lands. I'm so proud to host Jamie Thompson today on InstaDeath Survivor Support Group. Before we get started, a quick note. For the first 15 minutes or so of the interview, my audio was flowing through my laptop mic. Oops. But Jamie sounded great. Luckily, I eventually noticed my boneheaded move and switched to my sort of fancy pants podcaster mic. Having said that, this episode is special for several reasons. Firstly, it's the season finale. Don't worry, the show's not done yet, but I'm going to be taking a bit of a break to recharge and plot out my plans for season two. I've been teasing that season two will be a bit different, and I'm getting really excited about my plans. Can't wait to share those plans with you, and I hope you'll enjoy it as well. The second reason that this episode is special is that it features guest call-ins. I really love doing this. It was really fun to hear the voices of the listeners and patrons. It's one thing I'd love to make a staple of future interview episodes. And lastly, this episode is special because of the wacky antics of Jamie Thompson. So, without further ado, let's get to the interview. Today's guest is the author or co-author of several of the most beloved game books and game book series of all time. Talisman of Death, Way of the Tiger, and Fabled Lands, just to name a few. And it's with great pleasure that I welcome the great Jamie Thompson to the InstaDeath Survivor Support Group podcast. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. It's nice to be here. Although when you say Talisman of Death, you should really go Talisman of Death.
Let me try it. Talisman of Death. Does that work better?
Yeah, that's better.
I don't have the Dark Lord Mwahaha thing down yet.
Well, so. You're a young, innocent fellow. You haven't yet learned the ways of the dark side like I have. Also, I've extended my lifespan unnaturally by eating the livers of children and drinking the blood of Americans.
That's a dubious credential for somebody who has been writing some children's books.
Well, sell them books and then eat them. I suppose you're right, though. I'm actually reducing my potential market. Yes, you're probably right.
There's always more children.
Yes, that's true. There's always more children. A renewable resource.
Excellent.
Yes. Talking of Talisman of Death, that was the first game book I ever did when I was working at Games Workshop for Ian and Steve Jackson. And that was like in 1983 or something. And Ian and Steve did these fighting fantasy game books. And they were so successful, they couldn't get enough of them made. And so a lot of people who worked there, Joe Deaver and Gary Chalk and John Sutherland and other game book folk, had sort of read the early transcripts, you know, proofread them for Ian and Steve. And we were the only people in the country that really understood how they were made for the first time ever, if you can imagine that. So we easily just got contracts to write books, even though we weren't really writers. But me and Mark Smith, our first book, Talisman of Death, we wrote that out in longhand in pencil. Because I had a typewriter in the office, an old typewriter, remember, 1981. I couldn't afford a typewriter at home. And that's a really interesting different way of writing, because you have to pace up and down, as it were, thinking exactly how you're going to phrase the sentence, because you've got to try and get it right first time. So we wrote in pencil so we could make corrections. But nowadays, with modern word processors, you know, you could just rewrite and rewrite. And it's a very different method of writing.
When you were writing with pencil, were you writing on just standard paper? Was this index cards? Or how did you do that?
We had flowcharts. We developed flowcharts over time through big A3 pieces of paper, done with all the little circled numbers, arrows pointing everywhere, and death symbols, which was a death paragraph, and little dice rolls and symbols for combats. But it was, Talons of Death was interesting because it was all set in the world of Orc, which we then used for The Way of the Tiger, which was Mark Smith's Dungeons and Dragons campaign book. And it's one of the things that gave The Way of the Tiger and Talisman of Death this sense of a kind of flavor of realism to it, you know, in their fantasy. But it was because it was a living, breathing world. So his world had invented, he had two or three different groups because he was at Oxford University and they all played together there. And I went to school with him and then we would play in the holidays. So we would put characters from the role-playing sessions and their stories as the background. I remember in one instance, you go into a town and you just watch an event of someone having their head chopped off at the temple steps of a particular temple for offending Honoric, the leader of the Legion of the Sword of Doom. And that was an event that happened in our campaign to one of my characters.
A bit of light fun.
Yeah, a bit of light fun. And if you have all of these things happening in the background, it gives the world a greater feeling that it's not just you. There's a world going on around you. And you as Avenger can affect that world. But that's one of the things that gave it its good feel to it.
Yeah, Talisman of Death was your first game book. It was also, interestingly enough, it was the first game book ever mentioned on this podcast. We had Stuart Lloyd, who's a very enthusiastic promoter of game books and an author himself. And he mentioned it as the book that got him into game books initially. I'm curious, how did you find yourself at the Games Workshop company?
So I left university in 1980 or something. And I was wandering around, not knowing what to do, stuck at home, couldn't find a job. I was painting miniature figurines and creating a Macedonian army and also writing lots of role-playing supplements, playing D&D and stuff. And an advert came up in White Dwarf magazine for an editor, features editor in this case. And my mum came desperate to get me out of the house, to get me a job, showed me this advert because I got the magazine. I said, oh, don't be ridiculous, mother. That's like, you know, I should just apply straight out of university for the greatest possible dream job you could ever imagine. And I'll get that, sure. So I'm not applying for that, mum. What do you know? And so she actually rang up the Indominus without telling me and said, you know, I was freaky, obsessed, game-obsessed bloke. And Ian said, okay, send him up for an interview. So I went up for an interview and I got the job.
Thank you, Mom.
Yeah, thank you, Mom. Yeah, for giving birth to me and you're not sacrificing me to the dark gods of evil, as I would do basically with children. And then years later, because my mum lived in Bright, I went to school down there, there was a develop conference there. So every year, Ian Lewiston would often go down there. And I took him round to see my mum. She's passed now, sadly, a couple of years ago. But so it was lovely for Ian to meet my mum. So yeah, my mum got me the job at White Dwarf.
Wow. A reminder to be appreciative of what your mum has done for you, right?
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, I would have just become an accountant and be retired now. Not having to keep writing game books.
The world might have a little less fantasy adventure in it.
Yes, that's true. There'd be less death.
Speaking of the amount of death that you've peddled over the years, I think in the span of about 12 years in your most active game book writing years, you wrote somewhere around 30 game books, if I'm counting right.
Yeah, with various partners, 30 must be near that, yeah.
Some of those are, you know, the most well-known series. Actually, probably all of them are the most well-known series in game books. And so I'm curious, in your time writing game books, what are some of your favorite moments?
There are some great moments when you look back and you think, oh, that was rather well written. Of course, well written for Purple Probe. So I still remember some sections of Where the Tide that I'm proud of, but they're not exactly sort of literary geniuses, but they're wonderful Purple Probes. And there's a lot of good Kung Fu fights. So like things that I particularly remember. I remember going to one of those Friday Fantasy convention. I met this group of friends on Facebook now, but when she read them, she was a young girl at school. And she recited to me a particular paragraph from Talisman of Death. I think it's paragraph 285, I forget, but it's about when you're walking into the sewers, a harpoon goes through your back from a trap and spills your guts on the sewer floor. And it's a particularly horrible death. And she got in trouble at school for using this in a project, and the teacher was really shocked at how horrible the final was. So that stuck in her mind and stuck in my mind. And it's also got Talisman of Death on the news, because there was a time in the 80s where the books was thought they were too violent, or it wasn't that they thought they were satanic or anything like that. Although obviously House of Hell is. But it was more that they were too violent. But the funny thing about it was it made the sales of Talisman of Death shoot up virtually the next day. Because all the kids I want House of Hell because it's satanic, mummy, and I want the one where you get those guts filled up the sort of floor. I want that one. And I think the other one was Death Trap Dungeon.
I'd like to think that the parents who bought into that argument, I don't want that one Talisman of Death because it's satanic, mommy. Those are some good parents right there.
Well, this girl Helen was saying that mum really supported her. And she was very proud of her mum because she told the teachers, it's a bit graphic, but it's really getting my daughter reading. And it really was good for getting kids who wouldn't normally be great readers reading because they wanted to read about blood and gore.
In addition to your game book authoring career, you've also written a number of novels and young adult fiction. In fact, you won, for one of those books, you won the prestigious Roald Dahl Award. And that's one of your Dark Lord books.
Yes, the Roald Dahl Funny Prize. I beat David Williams. And he generously tweeted afterwards, congratulations to Jamie Thompson. I'm looking forward to reading his book. I bet he has. But anyway, I, of course, have been going around saying, eat it, Williams, or I'm a Dark Lord. But he's nearly 10 years ago, but still.
When you made that shift, was there any kind of mindset shift that was required for you?
There was, definitely, yes. Certainly in terms of the skill of writing. I became a writer. But my writing partner, Dave Morris, seems to be naturally gifted. He can just write stuff. I started as an editor and was told I had to write a book. I'll give you this money. And it was a game book, so I could do all of the game book and the fantasy stuff. But and I could write, I had some skill in it, but I'm not a naturally born talented writer. I have to work at it quite hard. And it is a skill like most other skills. So the more that you practice writing, the better you get at it. I suppose if I had a gift or talent, it would be the storytelling, the sort of strange ideas or somewhat whimsical plot lines, things like that. Because one of the things about game books, especially, for instance, is in Fabled Lands, because it's an open world thing, it's quite short paragraphs. It's endless adventure. So you have to think of maybe 30 or 40 different ideas that would become, that could be novels in their own right, like overthrowing the king of a particular kingdom in Fabled Lands. It's just one of many different quests that you could do. And you might do that 15 paragraphs, whereas that could be the entire storyline for Where the Tiger, the traditional three strands of narrative.
Right.
So to swap from game books into novels, they have a completely different structure too. So there's no, but at the end of the day, it's a narrative storyline and you have different beats and endings and you don't have all the nodes and stuff like that. So that was hard, but not impossible. But the thing that sold the book, I wrote it ages ago, and 2007 was the first. Well, me and Dave came up with the idea. We had this little company. We brainstormed stuff, and then we had all these ideas. Whoever we felt would be best at doing a particular project, we'd go away and do that one. So because of the comedy angle, I went away to do the Dark Lord books. And we couldn't sell the first one. We got Macmillan, who said that they liked it, and they got one of their editors. It was a young, up-and-coming editor. And she loved the book and said it had this strong voice running through it, the voice of the Dark Lord. And she did a kind of editorial thing on it. And so that really helped because that was a professional editor showing me what was wrong with the book and how I could fix it. Because there were certain problems resulting from the transition from being a game book writer to a novel writer. And then we were going to go back and have a big meeting. First meeting, we had three or four executives from Macmillan. And then it was 2008, if you remember the big crash. There was a big economic crash, and Macmillan laid off most of the people that I was working for. So that was leaving only the junior editor who had no power. And then years later, I went to see my new agent about something else completely. And he just happened to say, have you got anything else? And I said, well, I've got this in this drawer. And then the next time round, 3 years later, it's got in a bidding war and wins the world dark funny prize because there's no way of telling what's going on. The amusing thing about that is that my agent's name is Piers Blofeld, who is the famous Bond villain. So the agent's name is Blofeld, and the three main people in the running for it were a woman called Venetia Gosling, another one called Charlie Shepherd, who was a woman, and Megan Larkin was the editor at Orchard. Well, actually, she was somewhere else. But I always wondered if I put that into a book and put all those names in, no one would believe that they were silly made-up author names. Like, oh yeah, the agent's called Blofeld of the Dark Lord. Yeah, come on. It's quite fun. But it's interesting how, like, years later, it's a completely different market for a book, and it's a different story.
Right.
Which is kind of odd. And the other thing about The Voice, that was like 30 years of creating big bad guys in computer games and in game books, and having the player defeat them in battles meant that I had to create, I knew the Dark Lord's personality, if you could see what I mean, inside out, because I'd just been either defeating them or playing computer games against them or creating them myself for so long. The whole idea of like the Dark Lord, the Diary of a Dark Lord, you know, that the voice that they liked in it was the easy bit, because that came naturally to me.
Is that because you are yourself a Dark Lord?
Well, I understood it. And then because of having to do like this four Dark Lord books and lots of school visits with the, I had to create the persona. And also actually by writing the character of the Dark Lord, Dirk Lloyd, who's a 13-year-old before anyone doesn't realize, it's like the elevator pitch is an evil Dark Lord's defeated by the archetypal white wizard. Mm-hmm. He's cast into the outer darkness and he falls and he crash lands in a modern day Tesco car park or a Walmart car park. And he's worse than that, he's been cursed into the body of a 13-year-old boy. So the police find him and they say, "What's your name, boy?" And he goes, "Boy, I am the Dark Lord." And he comes out, "Boy, I am the Dirk Lloyd." Because he's got a squeaky boy's voice and they think he's called Dirk and they make him go to school. So that character became so real in my mind. I always found him talking in the back of my head. Because if you do four novels like that, you're so immersed in the world and the character. So wherever I go, I have to stop myself. I'll go into the shop and buy out a box of matches because I want to burn the village down. You have to sort of stop yourself from being the Dark Lord the whole time. What do you mean I'm a speeding officer? If you proceed with this ticket, I will destroy you. Don't you know who I am? I am the evil one. So when I go into shops, they say, "How would you like your coffee? Black and bitter like my heart." And so
Have you ever said that to a stranger?
Yes. I say it all the time whenever I order coffee. Mostly they laugh.
Yeah. Or they just back up.
Yeah, that happens too, you know, which is useful in COVID times.
Yeah, definitely. And so in addition to writing novels, you've also spent some time as a games developer, video games developer. So there's, I think, Warrior Kings and most recently Vulcanverse.
Yes, Warrior Kings.
I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious with Vulcanverse. Can you tell me anything about Vulcanverse? I know that that's not released yet.
Well, it's beta. It's essentially an MMO that is driven by NFTs and its own cryptocurrency. So it originally began with Greco-Roman mythological setting, four quadrants, Hades, Arcadia, the mountains of Boreas, who is a god of the north wind, the sort of Greco-Egyptian desert, the Sphinx and kind of Alexandria stuff. And my nephew actually created all this.
Oh, cool.
And he did a land sale. And the land sale were plots of land of a fixed number in the Vulcanverse that were NFTs, non-fungible. I don't really understand the technology, to be honest. They buy and sell this land for real money, or cryptocurrency that they is real money when you convert it if you want. Mm-hmm. And he raised something like $1 million, I think it was, just to start off as the development for this MMO. So it's sort of got these landowners who own, and I've got some, actually, it's just weird to imagine that you have a virtual sale of virtual land that people buy. Mm-hmm. And then you can pay to develop tools that are being provided by the MMO to develop your own land. So you can make it into whatever way you like.
Yeah.
And then sell it off
Yeah.
So you could, and if you buy it in Hades and Arcadia being green and lovely in Hades, for God. And my job has been to write all of the lore. So I've got all of the background tale and how the Vulcanverse came to be.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that Vulcan, the sort of engineer god of the Olympians, wants to create a kind of new Olympus. So all of the old gods are sleeping because man has stopped worshipping. But Vulcan is the techno god, as it were.
Yeah.
So he realizes he can't have Zeus on Olympus popping dead, turning into a swan and raping women left, right, center. Got to do something new. So it becomes like a digital universe. And yeah. He hopes he can bring the Olympic gods back.
It's almost like a fourth wall breaking thing. Like it knows it is a digital thing. Yeah.
And then you have these Vulcanites, which are creatures in the world, which are also represented by digital cards that are NFT cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a card game, like a, you know, online Magic the Gathering game set in it with all these cards that are also NFTs. And then there's an auto battler. And so I writing all the background and the lore and the card, you know, like the one-liners of the cards, the character names, and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And also doing game books, paper and pencil game books, as it were.
Yeah.
That aren't digital, that we might digitize and do as NFTs. So that we can, he wants to get the word Vulcanverse onto as many platforms as possible.
Yeah, right.
So it's actually been, and then there's the game book revival of recent years,
mm-hmm.
where the sort of retro vintage thing is, game books are kind of a bit culty now. So there's,
yeah.
there's we managed to reprint, it's not like we're selling, like we used to sell in numbers, but it's enough to justify or make it
right.
economically feasible.
I think we'll talk a little bit about the current state of game books soon. I'm curious with the Vulcanverse, you mentioned that you're going to do some tie-in game books. Can you tell me anything more about that and what your plans are?
Yeah, so it's me and Dave Morris. I'm going to do 5 game books. The one I've just done is Hades. The one Dave is doing is The Hammer of the Sun, which is kind of like Northern Egypt, but with a lot of Greek flavor to it. And the Arcadian one, which will be the one I do next, is The Wild Woods. And then the mountains will be The Pillars of the Sky. And they all have their themes. So Hades is full of shades. And I've just finished a sequence where you have to rescue Prometheus, who was the creator of men. Zeus didn't like the fact that he created, well, I said creator of men, some of these seven are the creator of men, it depends. But delving into the Greek myths, it's so rich. There's so much wonderful stuff I've forgotten about. Like in the early 70s, the Greek myths were my go-to mythology. Because all of this stuff that we think about now, all this sub-talking Warhammer and fantasy tropes that are so common, orcs, goblins,
mm-hmm.
they weren't really around then. You had a few authors of Jack Vance and James Roach Cabell and stuff, but they didn't really do the sort of Tolkien set off this whole new genre of what we expect to see in fantasy, ogres. So actually, and having spent so many years doing goblins, orcs, ogres and the rest, it's great to go back to the original Greek myths because they're so rich, so much good stuff. And I had some fun with some dead philosophers having a picnic in Hades. So they'll be sort of self-published. Well, it'll be Fabled Lands publishing. So mm-hmm. We're not going to put it into bookshops.
Right.
So it can only be sold online.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got these Germans, the French and Italian companies that reprinted the Fabled Lands books. They've expressed an interest in. Depends. England, it's very hard. Britain, it's quite hard to get game books into a shop.
Mm-hmm.
But you can sell them on Amazon and book depository and stuff. But in France and Italy, they still have outlets where you can buy them directly in a shop, it seems. So Italy particularly seems to have a quite thriving game book
mm-hmm.
community market.
Yeah. And
so that covers most of the bases.
Cool.
We've got a chap in Canada who might get them distributed in Canada, possibly even down to the States.
Yeah.
States would be good.
Well, fingers crossed for the States.
So we'll see.
Selfishly, fingers crossed for the States. Going backwards again, many of your game books are still seen as like the canonical classics of game books. And for me, the series that really resonates the most is, of course, Fabled Lands, which you authored with Dave Morris. And I'm really curious about the backstory there. How did Harkoon come to be?
Uh, I should point out that the Vulcanverse game books we're working on now are very open world fable lands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're not single narratives. You want to, we also made them a hell of a lot easier than the fabled lands. So we're trying to make them like console equivalents of the old hardcore Commodore 64 fabled lands games.
That'll be great. I appreciate in a sort of novelty kind of way that I know that my campaigns aren't going to last that long because I'm going to die.
Yeah. Well, even when I play them, I always take a character from book four, skirt along the coast. And you can do that pretty quickly in four or five paragraphs into Yellowpool. Mm-hmm. So I always have a rank four character for harvesting stuff so I can get some armor. And even I made the stupid mistake of walking into the land of the man beasts unprepared, found a helmet, put it on, was instantly killed. Yeah, I'd completely forgotten that, you know, oh my God, I'm a like fourth level warrior, but I've got to make a magic roll at that classic level. We'd make them easier now if we could. But the origin of the original Fabled Lands was my brother and I. There was a BBC, short period of time when the BBC started Radio 5, and their idea was to do sport on radio and try and get kids to listen to radio, which is kind of doomed. But anyway, we did a six-part, was it an hour long each episode or half an hour long each radio play called The Heart of Haku?
And, yes, I've heard it actually.
For that, I did it.
I didn't realize. So that came before the Fabled Lands books.
Yes. And it also came before Harry Potter. There's lots of people complain about how it's a story of a young wizard going to college. Mm-hmm. And the only difference was that our college is set in the fantasy land. If only we thought to set it into a kind of British boarding school, we would have been Harry Potter before. That was what she did. But people think that it's just a ripoff of Harry Potter because it keeps appearing on Radio 6 every year or so. They keep putting it out, probably because it's a bit like Harry Potter. But we did it before, in my defense, long time before. It was in the 90s, early 90s. Yeah. So I'd created the seeds of that world. Mm-hmm. So that was just basically, most of the play is set in Sokara, which is book one. Mm-hmm. And there's some mythology and gods that are in the radio series. And then Dave and I got together with this idea. I think I had the basis of some of the idea when I was in Australia, of how you could do this open world thing, which involves the use of code words and tick boxes. Mm-hmm. The idea being that some places in the Fabled Lands become like real places. So it's not just a paragraph in the air text, it's an actual location that you constantly go back to, and you can record stuff down in boxes. Mm-hmm. And some of the cities are, and then they change according to code words that you get by accomplishing things or with tick boxes, so that the world, you directly affect the world and it recognizes what you have done and changes accordingly. So you kill the ogre in the ogre's lair. The next time you go there, the ghost of the ogre is waiting for you, the specter. And when you kill the specter, the god of the ogres wants revenge and is waiting for you. When you kill that god, the gods get angry that you've slain another god and they all turn on when you wipe all the gods out. And so on. Well, that's a plot line.
Yeah.
What happens if you destroy it? So, but anyway, yeah, so that's the open world nature of it. The point being that there is a world that can change according to what you do. Yeah, but those are the basic building blocks you need to create that vast open world. And so our idea was to have one book covers one area. So the books themselves are also like locations. And that the idea that you could travel between them by turning to book three, you took paragraph so-and-so in book three. Mm-hmm. And all of that was completely new. And it was actually... There's also various computer games going on, like Might and Magic Clouds of Zine, I think it was, did something similar. And but of course, it's a computer game, so it could do it. So that's when all of these open world computer games were coming out. Even then, Clouds of Zine is quite like, but in Clouds of Zine, you could get your own castle and you could upgrade it. And that changes what it looks like and stuff like that. So we wanted to do what essentially was a CRPG in a game book.
Wow.
And there are problems. You can't do certain things. But on the other hand, you can do other more interesting things with books. Well, not necessarily more interesting, but certainly one of the advantages of a book is I'm not presenting to you my idea of what the ogre looks like. You read it, and then you create what the ogre looks like in your head. Mm-hmm. And that's it becomes, so the books become unique to every person and how they think that book looks or sounds like.
I think at the time that you did this, I can't think of any other open world series like that until recently. Of course, there's been a few connected open world series that have come out, including Legendary Kingdom series by Oliver Humid, the Spider-Mind games, and the Steam Highwayman series by Martin Nauch.
So, well, I met Martin and
excellent,
the Legendary Sourcebook guys at one of those Legendary Kingdoms. They called one, but here somewhere. It's great to see more of that happening. It's great that more people are doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, Legendary Kingdoms series just did very well on Kickstarter. It raised a little over $300,000. Yeah. And I'm curious if you take heart in that for the future of the Fabled Land series.
Oh, very much. Dave and I are actually discussing how we could do something and how we could get the reach that they managed to get to raise that much money. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking more of perhaps something entirely new that's game booky like that, but has more board gamey aspect to it. Mm-hmm. So it's more like a sort of solo, bit more Gloomhaven, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With cards, and I really want to do a space adventure one where you're traveling the galaxy to go to a little planet. I'd love to do that. And you create your own spaceship using cards.
Right.
Stuff like that. But the worry about that is it just doesn't sell as much as fantasy.
Maybe you could do a combo where it's fantasy, but you can fly to different planets or something.
So you would have to create something entirely new with toy and thinking about it. I haven't read any of the other ones because I have to confess that after having written so many, I don't really enjoy playing them.
Oh, no.
Or reading them anymore.
Oh, yeah. It's just sort of.
You know, I remember you used to play and read them, but now it's just like, oh, God, not another game.
Wow, that's funny. I guess I could see getting exhausted.
I mean, like, this looks very messy, but it's kind of working on at the moment. Oh, it's, of course, a picture, so you won't see it on the podcast, but it's my messy flow. It's upside down.
Flow chart, yeah.
Yes. Flow chart of the game book, so.
Yeah, very cool. And this is for Vulcanverse?
Again, a world open world. Yeah, this is for the houses of the dead. So you have little sections like this one says, the volcano of Thanatos. That's the volcano of death. And then you have the section is Argo and the River Lethe. So there's a little Jason and Yago. Well, actually, Jason's not there, but the River Lethe is one of the rivers of forgetfulness in Hades. And that sort of thing. Character generation in growth.
Very
That's
cool.
A bit unusual. So we've got quite a substantial section of creating your character. So you do a sort of, rather than just roll a dice for your skill and stamina, you have to make choices about
what. Oh, that's really cool.
And they influence your skills.
Yeah, so it's like,
and we made it easier.
Character creation is a story itself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
And there are sort of four gods like Ares, Apollo, Athena, and Artemis. That's it.
Yeah.
But they correspond to four simple skills. And those are just the skills with Fabled Land sort of rules. Two dice, get higher than skill check. But there's a sort of inbuilt revivification system, so it's quite hard to die permanently.
Very cool. Before we run out of time, some of the patrons of the podcast were kind enough to send in some questions.
Oh, yeah, go.
They're very excited about you coming on the show. So the first one is from Yunha Lee.
Hello, I'm Yunha Lee, and I really enjoyed coming across the Fabled Lands books in South Korea, of all places. I wanted to ask, is it hard to adjust to writing game books in different formats like Fabled Lands versus Fighting Fantasy, or do the skills really transfer pretty directly from different type to different type? Thank you so much for everything. Bye.
Thank you for the question. Actually, they are quite different, and you have to get into a different mindset, but it's not too difficult, because if you think about the open world, we touched on this earlier, so in the way of the title, in a given Fighting Fantasy especially, it's very linear. Although often there are usually three paths that connect up at nodes along the way. So you get a kind of tied up umbrella look to it. If you imagine it, an umbrella flapped around, that's perhaps not a good analogy. But the three roots then join at a node and then they split again. Well, they may all be completely like, take Lord of the Rings. In a linear thing, you'd start in Hobbiton and you might go up north, as they do in the books, through the mountains down through Rohan. If it was a game book, you might also include an entire sea trip all the way down and up to the far Harad and up to Minas Tirith. Or you might go south from the Hobbit straight to Gondor, across the mountains all the way over there. And each one would meet up on the way, different things would happen. So that also means a limited number of encounters. You might have 25 or 30 combats along that way, or encounters. Mm-hmm. And there's much more room for description and character of the characters of the people you meet. And you follow that path in the Fabled Lands. You're all over the place. You can go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You have to keep, it's much more complicated because you have to keep a record of what the player has done that isn't just what items they have. Because in a normal linear game book, you die and start again. In the Fabled Lands, you can be resurrected and get your stuff and have stuff stored. So it can't be defended by what objects you carry. And that changes, you have to do a lot more short, snappy puzzles and ideas and encounters. As I was saying before about how one of the storylines is the overthrow of an entire nation, is just one of many storylines in the Fabled Lands. So the paragraphs are much shorter and have to be much more incisive and, what's the word? Brevity is another word for what it is. So they're short and snappy and there's less room for characterization and description.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going, because you've got 750 to 800 paragraphs as opposed to 400. So they are different in the way you approach it, the way you plan it, and also the way you write them. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Makes sense. The next one's from James.
Hi, Jamie. My name is James Shanup, and my question is, are there any of your books you feel are overlooked? What's your hidden gem that you wish more readers would discover?
Yeah, I suppose the Falcon series, particularly book three of Falcons of the Rack of Baal, in which I shamelessly ripped off The Thing and Alien. No, I mean homage, made a great homage to. But I particularly like this planet called Dust book. The seas are made of dust, and there are these sort of waves that go out into the dust. But yeah, the Falcon books are time-traveling historical stroke science fiction game books where you're part of the Time Police. Can't remember the name of Time. They're called Temporal Investigative something Executive. And you've got to stop bad guys from changing the course of history for their own needs.
Mm-hmm.
A bit like the Umbrella Academy, if you've ever watched that, except you're the good guys instead of, I haven't finished series two of Umbrella Academy yet, but I'm convinced that they claim they're preserving the timeline, but I think they're just keeping it for their own purposes, whatever they may be. But you go all over the place from the Mongols to Napoleonic time to future to other planets. And we had a whole, me and Mark Smith again, we had to work out all the law, well, the rules of the time travel that we had chosen for those books, because there's always different rules for different time travel stories. So we had to create all of that. And they didn't do that well. And we re-released book one of the Falcon series and they didn't do very well either. So it's just because of time travel, I think. People like fantasy primarily. So yeah, the Falcon series is, although a lot of people really like them still, and book six in the series, I think, is preposterously expensive on eBay and secondhand now because it's become a collector's thing. But digging around to find three or four of them, but I don't think I've got them.
Yeah,
I've got several of one of Mark's Falcon books. Had I known, I would have looked after all of my game books much better.
Right. Yeah.
Just made a bit of money on them. So yeah, my hidden gems of Falcon haven't really done that well, sadly. Yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely seen them referenced a number of times as great books. I haven't been able to read them for exactly the reason that he just mentioned, which is they tend to be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
And so the last question here is from YK.
Hi, I'm YK from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm excited that you're coming on the podcast, and I'm curious about how your collaboration process has varied with different co-authors. Thanks.
Well, it's quite simple. I dominate them until they obey my every command out of fear.
As any dark lord would.
Of course. Absolutely. Or the other day, I do some videos for the Vulcanverse, which are crazy set here. started all wearing masks and all this crazy stuff. And in them, I got a big bowl of water, and I put a cauliflower in it and some glasses on it and put a kind of red dye in it. So this is the brain of Dave Morris. I finally enslaved him. I put his brain in a fit bowl of water, no, nutrient fluid, and thus I can force him to write game books for me for all time. More seriously, though, Mark Smith was my first collaborator, and we went to school together, so we've known each other since the age of 12 and played lots of Dungeons & Dragons games together. And I was in a position at Games Workshop to have the contract. And one of the things, it's funny how so many game books are collaborators working together. One of the reasons for that is you have to think of so many ideas. And so you bounce them off each other to create. Mm-hmm. And also I was bringing the contract and the ninja idea. And Mark was bringing the world of Orc, Middle-earth, mm-hmm. sort of ninjas in Middle-earth sort of thing. And it's also quite intimidating when you're 24 and the man you're working for has just sold a book, 120,000 copies in the first week in England or something. And a big publisher like Macmillan or Puffin comes along, here's some money, write me a book. Mm-hmm. So you need that support to support each other. But primarily it's bouncing ideas off each other because you have to create so much plot stuff. So Mark and I worked together for many years. We sort of burnt ourselves out doing game books. Dave I met through Mark Smith, because Dave went to Oxford too, where he met Mark, and we just clicked. And we've sort of hit it off since. We know how we think and sort of ideas we have. We created this Fablelands company and have worked together on so many things. It's not that we don't fall out sometimes. We do. You work with people, you know, you have disagreements. Sort of go wrong, but as the years go by, you get less agitated by such things. Mm-hmm. And we've learned to work together very well. So, yes, and there's also the testing of game books. They're very complicated. So it's very useful to have fresh eyes looking on something so that you're not, so you're the wood for the trees thing. Mm-hmm. You can't see the wood for the trees, but if you, so the other part that you're writing with can say, well, this bit doesn't work. You need to fix this. This paragraph number is wrong. So it really helps with the game book to have someone to work with. Well, it tended to go, I can wave the tiger, we'd think of the whole plot line and have important bits that we both had to be aware of. But then we just go away. So most game books, even numbers, most Way of the Tiger, for instance, the even numbers I think are written by Min, and I write the, Min is Mark Smith, that's his nickname, and I write the odd numbers, that sort of thing. And so there's also bits where you just go and do your own thing, and you have to check in with each other to make sure you're not doing the same thing, replicating anything. And also you'll tell the other guy, can you put this potion of invisibility in your section there, because the player needs it to do this bit I've written over here. And stuff like that. You know, you might write little sequences in each other's bit as well. So, especially Fabled Lands, actually, that's the one where you've got, you're right, Mark was writing book two, and Dave, sorry, was writing book two, and I'm writing book one. So, mm-hmm. there's all this crossover. So, you've got bits and pieces of objects, codes, words, items, events mm-hmm. that need to understand each other.
Having written solo and also collaborated, which is your preference? Do you prefer to work alone or with a collaborator?
Yeah, to agree. Yeah. I mean, even the Dark Lord books, the 90% me writing them, but a lot of the plot lines are thrashed out with Dave in our brainstorming sessions, which usually involve whiskey. I remember one thing. I've got it somewhere, actually. It might not be this one, but it's an old notebook. And in the beginning, it's got some pages, and I'm writing out the ideas, and they're quite lucid and well written. And then as the evening progresses, I kind of just get more and more insane. So we're just getting drunker and drunker. Until by the end, they're just these sort of scrawls of hopelessly unreadable. Just like occasional word that I've somehow, I expect I'll know what that means. But so I suppose I haven't really done much just on my own. I guess I've always been writing with someone else.
Cool.
I suppose the Dark Book's the nearest.
Yeah.
Nearest thing to doing it on your own.
Cool. So I mentioned that I wanted to come back to the current state of game books, and I'm curious about your thoughts on game books and where the market's at today and all of that.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of kind of strange that that there is one at all. I get that the retro scene, like you read it when you were 12 and now you're 40 and you're reading it to your own kids or whatever it is, and you've got some money, why not? But game, so many different types of entertainment compete against each other. So reading novels competes against playing computer games, against watching Netflix, against watching films, against reading game books. So I'm sort of surprised that people are still choosing game books. And it might actually, there might be an element of it that isn't just the retro thing, but that people are want to break from computer games. And they want to play a book and a game at the same time, because it's different. And I think one of the reasons for that is one of the things we touched on earlier. So when you read a book, it's yours. It's not just the art director saying to you, this is what the world looks like, according to how we think it. So your version of Gandalf is not the same as my version of Gandalf when you're reading the books. Obviously, everyone's version of Gandalf is now the film guy. But let's say you're playing it as a venture in the game books. You've got your own, bad one as well, because you just got a ninja outfit. But you know what I mean. You're going to have your... So they're all the same. You've got your own idea about what your character looks like. That sort of thing. That's one of the advantages of books. I think that's probably a big part. And just the break.
Yeah.
From... and the interactivity in a different way that you can, you know, some mobile phones on the train. But that's one of the things that it used to be. You could play a game book on the train. So I don't know quite why it's doing, it seems to be getting bigger every year as well.
Yeah, I can't quite put my finger on it. Reflecting on my own personal story, I actually didn't really discover game books until late last year.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, I was born in the mid 80s and, game books were kind of, you know, mostly kind of over by the time I was of reading age. You know, Choose Your Own Adventure in the US was popular-ish, but I wasn't a big reader in general. Right. And, So with COVID happening, I think there's that sort of time thing happening too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of locked up at home and needing to adventure. So maybe that's a piece of it, but also, you know, there are a slate of, very passionate modern authors who are doing, you know, the self-publishing thing and producing some really cool stuff.
I'm part of the Facebook group. So I'm friends with them on Facebook. But yeah, I didn't really read them. I have written so many of them. Don't make me read a game book.
I'll just add this to say, Jamie Thompson is a huge fan of game. No, I'm just kidding.
Dude, you probably should. I shouldn't say that.
I'm just kidding.
I can't help it.
I'm
enjoying writing it, so maybe.
And you mentioned the retro aspect and how some of these game books are going pretty expensive. Some of your game books included are going pretty expensive on eBay. I'm curious how you feel about the secondhand market, because I know you're not benefiting directly from that. Any thoughts on that?
Well, obviously I want to destroy them all and burn all libraries. What could possibly be wrong with that? Well, yeah, but I've been around for a while now, and so secondhand books are just a thing. Okay, so what can you do?
Yeah.
It's quite cool, you know, that they're collector's items, seeing some of those books go. Earlier on, a few years ago, you would get Fablelands books going for 70 quid or more in places. We sort of chase, that's kind of nice. I mean, those old, they are collector's things, really, especially the old Fablelands books with the pull out stuff. And we haven't really replicated that, or have we, in the big version of our latest Fablelands? But when we republish them, that brings down the secondhand price a lot, which is a shame in one sense, but in another, it's nice to put them out and fix the problems with them. And
yeah, right.
They like redo book six of Inferno, which was David Walter's writing, and book seven, which was great. So that enabled new writers to come through and carry on the torch, as it were.
Yeah.
So I don't think I could write another Way of the Tiger book. I mean, I could. but I don't know if I could, you know, I mean, we got so burnt out.
Yeah, right.
We'd done so much so quickly. It was too much. And it's a shame because in hindsight, perhaps we should have just not bothered with the Dune Master books, which didn't sell very well, and just done a few more Way of the Tigers and tried to get up to our original plan of 12 from Way of the Tigers, because
do you think
they were the most successful series.
Do you think you'll ever sort of take the Fabled Lands route with Way of the Tiger and like bring in new authors like you did with Paul?
Well, we did, Paul Gresty did book 7, yeah, so he's going to do book 8 probably. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, now that I've done all this, I might do some sections in book 8.
That's cool.
But yeah, probably, maybe we'll do more now because we've sort of got our game book feet back again. Is that the right word? Game book feet? Game book hats?
Yeah.
Okay. Through doing this. But then this is sort of new and more interesting. So it's always difficult to go back to old stuff. But we might do some sections in future ones.
Yeah, right.
We need to do some Kickstarters, but they take so much time and energy too.
Yeah.
That it's hard to find some space to do that in. So, but we plan to. Yeah, we want to get more Fabled Lands done. Paul's keen to do another one.
Yeah.
Although we have to be careful, the ones he does aren't too good. Otherwise, he'll show us up.
Fabled Lands as it could have been.
Yes. The better version. Those old fools, they couldn't do it. I want to, yes, and may have to destroy him.
Awesome.
He's pretty good, though.
I've been enjoying
the other book thing. 7. It's also huge.
Yeah, it is.
It's the other, yeah, and also some of those legendary kingdoms ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. They're all, and the Steam Highwaymen. It's slightly annoying because now we have to do longer ones to compete, keep up with them. Put Martin Nooch in my cellar. Make him write my name. Yeah.
Yeah, you could do worse, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, what's coming next for you then?
Well, there's this Vulcanverse thing and then another one. And then it may be, well, probably the Vulcanverse will probably take all of our game book energies for the next 6 months at least, I would think. But after that, there might be some Dark Lord stuff, but I'm not allowed to talk about that.
Okay. Very cool. And before we go, is there any projects that you'd like to promote?
Well, there's the Vulcanverse at the moment I'm doing. There's also the project of Jamie's Beer and Donut Fund, which is just a Kickstarter to keep me fat and beard up. So you just give me money, basically.
Is that live now?
And in return, in return, I give nothing. I'm not sure how that's going to work. So try it. Kickstarter just for burgers and beer.
Where should people go to learn more about Vulcanverse?
Well, there's vulcanverse.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there, www.vulcanverse.com. So I think there's a game book tab, and there's also all the lore and everything there.
Right.
Although recently it's somehow gone wrong, I must remind them to fix the website.
Okay.
So that's going to be interesting because of all the NFT thing. It's completely unusual.
Yeah, I mean,
and we're hoping, we haven't done it yet, but we're hoping to cross over between the game books and the MMO world. So you might find some code words or things that will unlock stuff in the game books in the MMO world.
Awesome.
The only downside of that is, so we might say, tick the code word in book 2 of, if you have the game books and the vault, which would be kind of cool.
Yeah, right.
But on the other hand, if it's an MMO, it'll soon come out. That's the other thing, that you're doing it on the background of, for the background of social media. So puzzles, they're soon, as soon as just out there. I remember trying to do a computer game with Dave back in the 80s. We had to ring a guy up in California to ask him directly what the solution was and find the right time for him to, you know, all that sort of thing, and hope that he will tell you the actual design. Whereas now, of course, all puzzles and problems for computer games, anything, it's just a minute away on the internet.
Yeah.
Because like the Talisman of Death, eventually I had to go into Ian's office, and Ian and Steve had just bought some word processors for the first time, which I think were like 20 grand or something. And then we could type up all the books then completely. And then you had to print them all out and deliver them as paper manuscripts in the post or by they actually drive up to the London publisher and put it through the door or risk losing the post. Because copies, there was no... So that was it.
Wow.
Until finally, it didn't take long before we were delivering them on floppy disks.
Yeah, right.
Just a few years later. And now I just email them. It's incredible.
Yeah, things have certainly gotten a bit easier. Very cool. Well, Jamie, it's been a real privilege to have you on the show. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Mr. Hazard. What a good game book name.
James told me that I should start signing off with, thank you for hazarding a guest.
Oh, very good. Yes. Well, so you have to change your name, Brian, to something more dangerous.
Yeah.
Laser Hazard. Chase Hazard.
Yeah.
Chase Hazard or his proper name, I suppose.
I need
Lord.
I need
Hazard.
Yeah, I need something that can stand up against the Dark Lord.
Nothing could stand against the Dark Lord. Your only choice is to swear fealty for all time and I'll spare you. That's my wormling minion.
So that applies, I think, to all of our listeners as well.
Yes, of course. They're all wormling minions.
All right.
And then I can say things like, unleash the hazard.
I like that. I like that. I'm definitely going to steal that little bit. You saying unleash the hazard. It'll be a
unleash
new.
Unleash the hazard, yes.
It'll be a new beginning to the show.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, it's unleash the hazard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
So that's it. Season one done. Jamie is delightfully crazy, and I'm really glad I got to have him on as my finale guest. I just wanted to chime in here at the end and thank all of you for listening in to this first ever season of Insta-Death Survivors Support Group. 21 episodes of fun. I started the show because I found a home within the gamebooks community. I had never before been welcomed so warmly by a group of strangers on the internet. The medium of gamebooks as interactive fiction is such great fun, but it's really the fans of the genre that make it such a unique hobby. So I also wanted to take a few moments to thank some of the people who made this season possible. So special thanks to all of my interview guests. It was a lot of fun getting to know the people who make these great works. Stuart Lloyd, Oliver Hume, Victoria Hancox, Simon Palmer, James Day, Troy Anthony Shermer, Patrick O'Neill, David Lowry, James Shanip, Samuel Isaacson, John Lunn, Peter Blinkarn, Michael Lee, Louise Lee, Simon Burks, KJ Shadmond, and Jamie Thompson. Thank you all of you for coming on the show and spending some time with me. And to the contributors, Jesse Johnson for the great theme music, Patrick O'Neill for the cover art. Thank you so much for what you added to the show. And to all of my patrons over at patreon.com/instadeath, I really couldn't have done this without your support. Ryan Hagen, James Shanip, Yoon-Ha Lee, Louise Lee, Stuart Lloyd, and YK Lee. I really appreciate your financial contributions. To my wife, Crystal, for allowing me to indulge my time and money on this glorious hobby. And to my son, Declan, whose look of wonder when asked what should happen next during a bedtime story inspired me to seek out game books in the first place. And to every single person who has listened to an episode, thank you. It's your enthusiasm, support, and contributions for a unique and participatory form of art that has made this show possible. I look forward to seeing all of you in season two of Insta-Death Survivors Support Group. If you'd like to keep tabs on the behind the scenes as I develop season two, head on over to patreon.com/instadeath, where I'll be discussing some of my plans and getting feedback on show format and other things that I'm dealing with. Can't wait. See you on the other side. Thank you so much for supporting the show. If you'd like to help even more, rate and review Insta-Death Survivor Support Group anywhere you listen to podcasts. A special thanks to our guests and to the contributors who helped make the show better than I ever could on my own. Intro music graciously provided by Jesse Johnson, aka Zenoda. Find more great music by searching Jesse Johnson or Zenota, spelled with an X, on YouTube and most major streaming platforms. Podcast cover art generously contributed by Patrick O'Neill. You can learn more about Pat's art on his Facebook page, Pat O'Neill Art.